Welcome back. 25 minutes more of Open Lines. We had an hour before. The better part of that hour was taken with hearing from leaders of the feminist majority, NARAL, Pro-Choice America, National Organization for Women, Planned Parenthood Federation of America. They're announcing a April 25th, 2004, March for the Freedom of Choice in Washington, D.C. We heard from quite a number of them, including a Baptist minister, the Reverend McDonald, who was casting a new vision for America. And we'll hear from a few more, actually a few of those again, here in this 25 minutes of Open Lines when we take your reaction to this, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Kent called last hour. He had made reference to a Meet the Press. Yeah, this was Meet the Press, Face the Nation interview with presidential candidate Dick Gephardt. And I've got the transcript in front of me. The pertinent questions about abortion I'll share with you in just a moment. Feel free to give us a call. Your reaction to this big march that will take place on the 25th of April in 2004. And the plans to, well, one of them said this is the moment. April 25th, 2004 is the moment that will determine whether or not Roe stands for generations or falls for generations. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. One of the things that I found interesting about that, and it's really only comes out in the first couple cuts of the sound that we played for you last hour, was the repeated references to our generation, my generation. One of the ladies said, I don't want it to be my generation that both won and lost a woman's right to choose. And we heard others saying, my generation is upset. They didn't use those words, but my generation is upset with the Bush administration. What is this generation stuff? Okay, maybe it's just me. I am the tail end of the baby boom generation. All right? I'm at the tail end of this baby boom generation. And so I don't have a lot of the baby boom sensibilities where I identify more with my generation than I do with, say, what? My wife? My religion? Who knows? Never really seen myself as part of a generation. Finally had to admit a couple years, like an alcoholic. Hi, I'm Todd. I'm a baby boomer. Hi, Todd. Had to finally do it, okay? There should be a BBAA, shouldn't there? A Baby Boomers Anonymous, where you can go, a BBA, and you can share your woes and stand there and, hi, I'm Todd. Hi, Todd. Tell us your story, Todd. Well, for years, I didn't think I belonged to any generation. I fancied myself a Gen Xer. I mean, I had a lot of the traits. I was cynical. The whole thing. I was looking for authenticity and truth, and then I finally had to admit that I was a baby boomer. Well, you're brave. That's the first step. You're brave to admit it. The first step to understanding and solving a problem is admitting that you have one. They should have a group like that. I'd be a member. Anyway, what is it about this generation of feminist women who see this as kind of a badge of honor for their generation? Who say, if we fail, it's a generational thing. I think this is sad. This is sad. They have nothing more to say for their generation than that they have procured a woman's right to abort her child, that will be the thing they want their generation remembered for in history? Tom Brokaw writes this book called The Greatest Generation. It sells millions. He writes a follow-up to it. People say, finally, someone is giving credit where credit is due to a generation of men and women who sacrificed at home and abroad in times of peace and at times of war to give us, you and me, their children and their grandchildren, and ensure for us the blessings of liberty. Now, there's a generation who has something to say, that's what we'd like to be remembered for. And they will be, by the way, because a lot of their bodies are laying out in national cemeteries. There's also another They're not in cemeteries. There's another long line of corpses laying out someplace. They're not in cemeteries. Most of them gone up in smoke and incinerators. That are the legacy of this generation of feminist leaders whose claim to fame is we left those people, those human beings, those babies dead. After 30 years, every time a baby is aborted, they count it as another victory for their side. And after 30 years, they have racked up a lot of victories. And they're proud of it. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I want to take up some loose ends here, and then I'll go to the phones. And we'll hear a little bit from Kim Gandy and from Eleanor Smeal, two of the best bites from the last hour. Bob Schieffer of Face the Nation had this question for Richard Gephardt on Sunday. The Republican National Committee, which keeps track of these things and says you have missed 85% of the votes in the House this year, one of the votes that you missed this past week was the one banning late-term abortions. It's actually a ban on partial birth abortions, Bob. What some are calling partial birth abortion, would you, he asked Gephardt this question, Gephardt running for president, would you have voted to ban that or not? What would your position have been on that? He was absent from the vote. He could have been there if he wanted to, but he was absent. Gephardt responds, my position is and has been that I would vote for a ban on late-term abortions, but I would insist on an exception for the health of the woman. I think that's very important, and I would, if I'm president, not sign a ban that did not contain an exception, because I think that's vital. Schieffer then asks, talk a little bit about abortion and your position on it, because it may well be that we see one of these Supreme Court justices announce his or her retirement this summer. Do you think abortion choice should be a litmus test for anyone selected to sit on the Supreme Court? Good question. Good question, Bob. Gephardt responds, I think that you should try, and this is the quote to which Kent was referring when he called earlier, I think that you should try to pick judges who are balanced and fair and will stick with the precedents of the court and not try to be going off in new directions, plowing new ground. I think some of the candidates that this president is putting up, both for Supreme Court and for other courts, are really right-wing extreme judges who have right-wing extreme views, and they would like to plow new ground in that area. This is what infuriated Kent when he heard it. For instance, I think that if George Bush can put a lot of new judges on the Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade is in danger. And he doesn't want them. Again, he says, I don't think that these are the kind of judges we need on the court. I think we ought to have a balanced, fair judge who tries to maintain precedents of the court and not to use it as a way to plow new ideological ground. Then when asked, as president, would you nominate someone to sit on the Supreme Court who is not pro-choice? That's a better question, Bob. That's a better question. The answer is, I don't think I would. Because I'd put on people who have a proper respect for the precedents of the court, and the court has said that choice is the law of the land. Now, Kent rightly pointed out, and aptly pointed out, that this is not the way the Supreme Court system works, and this is not the way precedent in the law works. We do not send something up to the Supreme Court, finally get them to adjudicate a matter, and then say it's the law of the land and can never be revisited. Well, how can you say this isn't the Supreme Court? The Supreme Court? Yes, it is. But the Supreme Court can overturn itself. It has that ability. It has the ability to revisit subjects and to change its mind. It's done it on several occasions to the betterment of our country. And I would point out to Richard Gephardt that this would not be plowing new ground to revisit Roe v. Wade. That furrow is only 30 years long. There's a furrow that came before it where abortion was illegal in this country. That's not just 30 years long, it's 200 years long. So if anyone was plowing new ground, Representative Gephardt, it was the Roe Court, and not any greatly feared former Bush Court. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Ty, welcome to Issues, etc. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, no problem. How are you doing today?
Doing well.
When you were speaking about generations, I actually had a thought that I really don't think has ever really occurred to me before. And without getting too deeply into the scandal for the sake of my family, let's just say I was born in June of 1972 under some, some very difficult circumstances with, some paternal questions that were going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've ever actually sat to think, had I been born just, a matter of months later? We're talking June of 72 I was born. How different my fate may have been. And if anything, if I want to associate myself with any sort of generation, perhaps it's a generation of might not have been.
Survivors.
Mm. Anyway,
Ty, thank you very much. My goodness. I want you to all think about that. My little brother, I love my little brother. He was born in 1974. January 1974. He was born in an America where he could have been aborted. His mother, my mother too, by the way, we share the same mother, that's why he's my brother. My mother was 35 years old when she conceived my little brother. The doctor suggested the possibility that she was a little too old to have a baby and that she might think about an abortion. She didn't think about an abortion. But she could have. My little brother, who is now over in Iraq, fighting with some combat engineers, almost captain in the U.S. Army Reserves, well-paid engineer when he's at home, wife of a three-year-old daughter, college graduate, the pride and joy of his whole family, his four older brothers and his parents, church-going Christian, taxpayer, and good citizen. Might not be around today. Might not have ever been around for anyone to see, just like Ty. And you see, he was born into a family where both parents were married. We knew who Dad was. Mom was just a little too old. At least they thought she was a little too old at the time. Best thing ever happened to our family. Best thing ever happened to our family was the birth of my little brother. Best, and I won't tell you why, but I will tell you, it was the best thing that ever happened to our family. And those good things may have never happened if my mom would have thought about an abortion. Ty, I'm glad you're around because we would have missed out on the many excellent conversations that we've had with this young man. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Chuck is calling from his car. Chuck, welcome to Issues, etc.
Hey, Pastor, how you doing this afternoon?
Doing well.
Not very familiar with your program. I just tuned in. I'm here on the road traveling from St. Louis back home, and I heard you talking about you're admitting that you're a baby boomer, and I was just curious as to how you came to that conclusion. I missed a little bit of your spiel on that.
Oh, thank you. I'll explain it, and thank you for the call. I had to admit it because it was a simple reality of the calendar. I said a little earlier, born on the very trailing edge, the very tail end of the baby boom generation. A couple more months, I wouldn't be a baby boomer. I would have been a something else-er. But every baby born between 1946 and 1964, 78 million they estimate, a big boom of babies. Every baby born between those two dates, a baby boomer. I had to admit it. It was a reality of the calendar. But that wasn't the only reason, by the way. I wanted, like everything, not to be a baby boomer because of all that so many of the boomers stand for. But I had to admit that I was. I wrote an article a couple of years ago called the Six Commandments, the Ten Commandments of the Baby Boomers? I don't remember. The Commandments of the Baby Boomers. In which I had to admit that many of the characteristics that mark that generation, I possess as well. It was, if you will, a bit of a coming out for me. It was not a manifesto, but a cleansing of the soul, a catharsis, a laying all my cards on the table face up for everyone to see. I feel better for it. I do. Now, there are other sociologists who have different time frames for the baby boom generation, but I had to finally admit that whether you counted it by the calendar or you counted it by the characteristics of the boomers, I was one of them. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Mike is calling from his car. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Pastor Todd.
What's up, Mike?
Okay. Hey, I wanted to make a comment about this abortion issue. In my perspective, it's more of a man's issue than a woman. Yeah, the woman has an abortion, but she, in many cases, and I'm very active pro-life. I go down to the abortion clinics a lot and get very involved in pro-life. But the man is the one that's free by abortion, not a woman.
You're right.
The man, you know, he just throws a piece of plastic at it and he walks away free, but the woman is never free from an abortion. And many women that get abortions, from my estimation, are like animals caught in a trap that are chewing off their leg to get free. You know, they're just caught between a rock and a hard place, and most of them don't want an abortion, and they're forced to by men.
Mike, thank you very much. You know, we had a recent conversation with someone who had done some research. I can't remember who she was, but you know, it all blurs together. She had done some research on Christian girls who have abortions, and one thing she discovered was that 7 out of 10, by the way, Christian girls from good Christian families have abortions at exactly the same rate as girls from non-religious families. Well, 7 out of 10 of the Christian girls who had an abortion said the major factor in them deciding to have an abortion was not their boyfriend or their, you know, whoever it was that got them pregnant. It was their mother. Their mother talked them into it. Now, that is not to discount what Mike had to say. It's true. There are a lot of girls who never consult their mother. And the boyfriend, he can. He can take out the plastic, slide it through the scanner, and he can walk away free. In fact, I would like to see a study done of how many marriages survive abortion. I would like to see a study done of how many long-term monogamous non-married relationships, we used to call it going steady or dating, how many of those survive abortion? I like his analogy, though, as gruesome as it is. Women who have an abortion, like a woman with their leg caught in a trap, at least they've been told their leg is caught in a trap. That's what they've been told. They've been told that their life is over. They've been told that their career is through. They've been told that they won't get an education, that they won't get a job, that they won't get a husband, that they will not be able to, they'll just be the welfare mother standing there barefoot on a dirt floor. They've been told that. They think they're caught in a trap. The fact of the matter is, the woman is always better off having her baby. And I can tell you that because the baby comes from God. He's the one who gives us children. Arpod is calling from St. Louis. Arpod, welcome.
What I want to say is that the old Eve and Adam situation is still going on. Eves are still picking the apples and invite Adam to bite into it. Thank you.
Thank you, Arpod. Now, that is a simple and profound way of seeing this. That's a simple and profound way of looking at this. The ladies who gathered there from the feminist majority, NARAL, Pro-Choice America, the National Organization for Women, Planned Parenthood, Federation of America, they're acting consistently with the first mother, aren't they? They're listening to the voice that would rob them of true life and bring death, not only for themselves, but for their children. I want you to think about this for a moment. Adam and Eve, when they stood there at the foot of that tree, and this is not to let Adam off the hook, by the way, because he had just as big a mouthful of the fruit as Eve did. He probably finished it off. She probably took one bite, and he probably finished it all the way down to the core. But Adam and Eve stood at the foot of that tree, and they had heard God's clear word, on the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. Now, they could not have imagined, or could they have imagined, that on the day they eat of it, they would not only be consigning themselves to death, but all of their offspring. Maybe they didn't even think about their offspring. Maybe they didn't consider that a relevant question. Maybe they thought to themselves, you know, this is a choice we can make, and why should we have to pay the consequences for this choice? Certainly there'll be a way to evade the consequences of this choice. Shouldn't there be a way? I mean, if they had a federal government in those days, I imagine Adam and Eve probably would have been standing on a podium someplace talking into a microphone about the right to choose. And by the way, once we've made that choice, we shouldn't have to pay any consequences for it. God had already told them what the choice would mean. Death. And abortion is just in a long line of new ways that men invent to do evil. But Adam and Eve were consigning us to death with their rebellious choice against God. They didn't care about us. They didn't. And in genuine repentance, Adam and Eve would be the first ones to admit it. They didn't care about us. They were consigning generations of human beings to death. No more than a woman who walks in, and under what other kind of pressure, who knows what kind of pressure, says, look, it's me or the baby, and it's going to be the baby, and that's the way it is. I'm fighting for my life here. It's the same choice. And it ends exactly the same way. Arpad, you're right. I'm sorry, I promised you that we would play some more of those sound bites, but we didn't get a chance. We did have an opportunity to take your phone calls, however. When we come back from this break, there was a front page story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Perhaps you read it for yourself. Archdiocese criticizes some organ retrievals. Hospitals are increasingly taking organs from patients who are declared heart dead. We'll talk about that concern with Father Ed Richard. He's an academic dean and associate professor of moral theology at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis. He'll join us after the break. It is always sad to have a conversation like this, isn't it? Because we are, again, revisiting the sad day of man's first rebellion, and we're watching it reenacted again and again, and with vigor, and with people asserting their rights. A young lady called in just a few minutes ago. She talked about the fact that she had an abortion, and I told her, you have the forgiveness that Christ won for you at the cross. When Jesus hung dying on that cross, he was dying for Eleanor Schmiel and her rebellion, and Kate Michaelman, and all the women who have heard the siren song of their voices and listened and followed into the path of death. He was dying for all of those sins. He was dying for my sins and your sins when we stand silently by, and when we, through our own rebellious choices, that may not have the same kind of immediately deadly consequences, when we rebel, he paid for it all. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Some of the most common ethical dilemmas that confront Christians today are found in the workplace. Do we operate by one set of ethics as Christians and another set in the business world? As you face workplace problems, where do you go to look for guidance? Answers to these questions and more are found in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, by Raymond Hilgert, Phil Lockus, and James Truesdell. You can order Christian Ethics in the Workplace by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or order the book online at issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section and you'll find information on this book. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace. 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. What do renting cars and pushing the homosexual agenda have in common? A large full-page color ad by Avis on the back of a leading gay magazine has a growing number of people asking just that. Stuart Shepherd reports.
It's in the current issue of The Advocate. The ad shows two men in a tropical locale. It reads, at Avis, domestic partners are automatically included as additional drivers. That's been our policy for the past 10 years. So why have we waited so long to tell you? Well, let's just say we came out in our own time. Mike Haley with Focus on the Family called Avis to see if business partners could get the same deal.
We would have to pay a $25 service fee for the other person to be on the rental. If I mentioned that I was a domestic partner with that individual, we would not have to pay a dime.
The ad also explains if customers use a special code, Avis will donate to the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation to help eliminate discrimination. Haley points out Avis is discriminating against small businesses in the process and...
They're supporting almost everything that the gay community stands for. Hate crimes legislation, same-sex marriage, domestic partnerships.
Their support of GLAAD really nails down their commitment to forcing this lifestyle upon America.
Buddy Smith is with the American Family Association.
We have to send a message, not only with what we would say in a phone call or a letter or an email, but we have to vote with our pocketbooks.
Avis and GLAAD did not respond to my request for interviews. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepherd.
GLAAD focuses on encouraging the positive presentation of homosexuals in the media. It supports gay marriage, homosexual adoption, domestic partner benefits, the announcement of same-sex unions in newspapers, and pushing for more gay characters on TV. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Zoofari 2003 celebrates penguins, puffins, and pearls this year in honor of the St. Louis Zoo's spectacular new habitat exhibit, Penguin and Puffin Coast. This creative black tie party is on Friday, June 13th, beginning at 7 p.m. on the zoo grounds. Live entertainment on four stages, food from nearly 60 of St. Louis's finest restaurants, and silent auction. Reservations are $225 per person for non-members, $175 for Zoo Friends members. Advance registration is required to Zoofari 2003 at the St. Louis Zoo.
In today's fast-paced business world, where compromise is easy, where can we turn for practical and moral guidance? Find out with a book, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Christian Ethics in the Workplace is the Issues Etc. book of the month for June, 1-800-325-3040. You can find out more about this book on the internet, issuesetc.org, and click What's New, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, our Issues Etc. book of the month for June.
We've come off an hour and a half of open lines talking about, well, you know what we've really been talking about? We've been talking about all of the worldviews that assault a Christian worldview. A Christian worldview would say that life is sacred and that that life, it deserves to be protected not only in law, but also in principle at every stage from conception on. There are other worldviews that are banding together to assault that particular Christian worldview. Darwinism that says, look, we're just blobs that evolved from blobs, and whether or not we're human beings really doesn't make much of a difference. We got to talk about who persons are. Sometimes even animals can be persons under a Darwinistic worldview. There's the worldview of postmodern tolerance, where a Christian minister can stand up and say, it's not really about what's right and wrong, it's about rights, like rights to choose. And he wants to live in a world where even that right is tolerated as virtuous. These are all worldviews, folks. They're not independently held opinions. They're part of systems of thought that people use that you need to be aware of. That's why I want to remind you with just a couple days to register about a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin. We'll be there broadcasting live several days. We'll have regular guests, Angus Manouge, Rolf Preuss, Craig Parton. We'll be talking to all of them. The Schwann Center is about 2 hours north of the Twin Cities in Trago, Wisconsin. You can call them for information before this Friday at 1-800-577-4848, 1-800-577-4848, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar, June the 20th through the 27th at the Schwann Center in northern Wisconsin. You don't have to attend the entire week. I'm not going to. I'm going up on Monday, coming back on Friday. You don't have to attend the entire week if you don't want to. There are flexible packages. You can find out about them by calling 1-800-577-4848. Now, yesterday I asked that anyone who was headed up to the Schwann Center for this Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar from the St. Louis area would contact my producer, Jeff Schwarz, at either this number, area code 314-505-7832, area code 314-505-7832, or by email at jschwarz, that's J-S-C-H-W-A-R-Z, at KFUO.org. There's a couple that would like to share the ride time and expense up to Trago, Wisconsin for this conference, and you can get in touch with them by getting in touch with Jeff, 314-505-7832, or jschwarz, J-S-C-H-W-A-R-Z, at KFUO.org. Jeff will put you in touch with the right people. We're going to spend the remainder of this hour of Issues, Etc., talking with Father Ed Richard. He's Academic Dean and Associate Professor of Moral Theology at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis. The front page story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch has to do with organ donation, organ retrieval, if is what it's really about, and some that are concerning, well, not just the Roman Catholic community, the Archdiocese of St. Louis, but also the rest of us as well. Father Richard, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd. Glad to be with you.
What is the basic concern here over this type or these types of organ retrieval? Lay them out for us and explain the concern.
Well, the procedure involves a protocol set up whereby a person who is not brain dead but is on a ventilator would be removed from the ventilator at a certain point. If the heart is to stop beating and respiration stops, then there would be a declaration of death. And then a waiting period of 5 minutes, at which point the person would be turned over to the transplant team for organ retrieval. And the concerns are, first of all, that the ethical justifications that have been stated for that do not seem to be clear about what would be considered the criterion for death, whether it would be irreversible cardiac cessation or irreversible brain death. And certainly there doesn't appear to be any scientific basis on which to claim that the brain function would be irreversibly lost at that point. So when you look at the cardiac criterion, the problem there becomes this complex decision to remove a person from the ventilator because a doctor has made a prognosis that there might be no hope of recovery, and then that decision being made with moving directly to organ donation. So it becomes very morally complex at that point.
Okay, so I'm looking at step one of each of these procedures. The one protocol where an organ is retrieved from a donor when there is actual brain death, when the brain is no longer sending any signals,
correct,
of any kind to the body to keep the body functioning. The body is functioning only on the impulses being sent from a ventilator or some sort of cardiostimulation. That's step one for retrieving organs with brain death. Step one for retrieving organs for those, I mean, the protocol is heart death,
mm-hmm,
seems to allow that there would be some brain activity, and that the way the heart is stopped from beating is by removing the ventilator from a person whose brain is possibly still capable of keeping the person alive.
Correct. The reason for the protocol precisely is that the person still has brain activity.
How common is the heart death protocol for organ retrieval?
Best indications that I have, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 2-3% of organ donors go through this process.
Now, is this concern shared by the St. Louis Archdiocese? Could we say that this is an official position on this kind of a protocol?
Well, all I can say is what the paper says is that Jim Orso, who is the communications director for the Archdiocese, according to the Post-Dispatch, said that it was the position of the Archdiocese and Archbishop Regali. In fact, when we printed the editorial, it was merely the position of the editorial that we thought that there should be clearer guidelines and that, you know, there should be doubt should be removed from this process, because when you ask these various persons, you get different kinds of explanations. So all I could tell you is about that at this point, because this has happened rather quickly, is that I don't know any more than the Post-Dispatch.
Well, what would be an acceptable solution, as far as you are concerned, with regard to your concerns? Would an acceptable solution be to say that we need to really eliminate the protocol that would allow for organ retrieval when someone is merely, quote-unquote, heart dead, when there still is brain activity?
Well, this is a complicated question, and it's complicated for a number of reasons. One is, with respect to Roman Catholic ethics, I'd have to respond on the one hand there that I think for the ethicist who would justify that as Roman Catholics, they need to establish an ethical basis for moral certainty with regard to death and using a criterion that is not irreversible loss of brain function. And that hasn't been done. And it certainly couldn't be done by 5 minutes of nothing being done for the person. The other thing that everyone should be concerned about is this the series of decisions and that are tied together. So I'm sure that great efforts are made to make sure that these are carefully considered and so on. But you have to remember that the irreversibility of irreversible loss of cardiac function in this case is based upon a decision to remove from the ventilator and not do anything to resuscitate the victim or the patient, even though there is not brain death. So I wonder if there has been sufficient ethical reflection by the community at large, and I think it's a good idea for this to come to light. So what would it take? I would think more reflection about the criteria for non-heartbeating organ donation, because it's not simply that the person has irreversible loss of cardiac function, which is certainly possible. It's that irreversibility is based on a number of choices not to resuscitate, a refusal of treatment, and this being joined to this interval of 5 minutes.
You know, that's what I'm looking at the process as it's laid out in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch front page article. And it appears to me that if you simply took it through step four, that is, first there's very little brain activity, then they decide to remove artificial support, they turn off the ventilator, they wait for the heart to stop beating, they wait 5 minutes to make sure the heart doesn't restart on its own.
Mm-hmm.
If you stop the process at that point, it looks to me like you basically, and I hate to put it in these kind of crass terms, killed somebody. If you took organ donation off the tail end of this process, you've taken someone who still has brain function, remove them from the ventilator, and let them die. I guess a lot of it depends on how much brain function's at work there.
Yeah, well, I mean, we believe that it's possible to refuse what we would refer to, or many people would consider to be disproportionate or burdensome or extraordinary treatment.
Certainly, yes.
So there's no problem there, but when you combine all these things together, it begins to get much more difficult. And what you're saying can be verified in one of the things that came to our attention in the preparation of the editorial's position was that, in fact, a few weeks ago, an Ohio prosecutor mentioned that the law there would prohibit removal of a person from a ventilator with brain activity, and that he mentioned, you know, he says, this is not something that I'm making up, but rather if the people who are involved with this have an issue, they should take it to the legislature, because otherwise I will charge them with a violation of that statute.
One of the general principles that I've operated with as a parish pastor in offering counsel to people when they're dealing with making plans for what they usually think of as extraordinary or, you know, life-saving procedures, things like that, and it's a general principle, it's not good for every case, and that is, don't begin something like a ventilator with someone if you plan later to take it away. Now, in some cases, that won't work, like with hydration. Sometimes when kidney function breaks down, you continue to hydrate someone, you're going to hasten death.
You cause trouble.
But in the case of a ventilator, where you're saying, we're going to put them on a ventilator, but maybe we'll take it away later, you're putting yourself into a position where you might have to, even with the best of intentions, cause death rather than allow death simply to occur.
Right. I think you have good insight there, because a person could become somewhat dependent on that. And I'm not an expert in the medical side of this, but the people that I consult with do talk about this. And, of course, if it's very difficult at that point with respect to the choices that you make and your will to separate yourself morally from what the ultimate consequences of that decision would be. So I think you have good insight on that.
Well, is this a problem only in public hospitals or privately owned hospitals? Is this a problem that might even exist in, of course, the St. Louis area is somewhat renowned for its fine medical care under the auspices of Catholic organizations?
Well, I think it's a procedure that is being adopted and discussed in practically all institutions, hospitals that would be capable of some way being involved or that would be involved in the organ retrieval and donation process. So most of this information, this is another thing, another area behind all of this is there are lots of guidelines that are put out by the government and by the transplant association everyone is expected somehow to address, so no one's exempt from that sort of thing.
Someone might be listening to this conversation and think that you are discouraging organ donation. Is that the case?
Well, actually, no. I mean, one of the things that we hope to come out in this process is to ensure or to bolster the public trust that has been built up and to secure and encourage organ donation. We don't want things to happen that would cause people to question its validity.
Do you believe, either in the medical, where your expertise does not lie, but in a moral sense, is it possible to arrive at an objective, verifiable definition of death that could be satisfied for those who would donate their organs?
Well, definitely with respect to irreversible loss of brain function, which is about 90% of all the cases of organ donation, in other words, the vast majority, that would be a morally certain sign of death. In other words, from a theological principle, that would be the separation of the soul from the body. We consider that to be a morally certain sign of death.
Folks, if you've read this front page story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today and you had a question or a comment, you can give us a call right now, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Think about it this way, folks. Have you signed the back of your license where you can donate your organs? If you have, this is a subject that you probably ought to take some interest in. Our guest is Father Ed Richard. He's academic dean and associate professor of moral theology at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis, and we're talking about that St. Louis Post-Dispatch story on organ donation and the concern that was raised by an editorial regarding whether or not the protocols for retrieving organs are always as ethical as they can be. Father Richard, your thoughts on the state of medical ethics in general. How do you think we are faring here in America with regard to medical ethics?
Well, without questioning the goodwill, again, of all the people involved, I think that people, you know, are trying to do the right thing, but we've had these two competing things in the background of medical ethics. One is a basic sanctity of life ethic, and the other is a more secular notion that was that pretty much has won the day, and that's sort of started by Joseph Fletcher, and more of a question of what constitutes personality and how much care should we give on the basis of whom we define persons to be or how we define persons. So there is a lot of influence of that, and I think where we have come to in many respects, and just in the medical culture itself, and what, you know, as part of what I would refer to as overall a culture of death, is that the human person and the individual would often be subordinated to other goods, or could be potentially be subordinated to other goods, because the sanctity of life is not placed as a higher priority or as high a priority as it should be. So I think we need to have some serious discussions about the priority of the person over medicine. In other words, medicine should serve the person. Human persons don't serve the medical culture.
Is the real problem there that the sanctity of life in some quarters, especially in medical ethics, is not considered to be an objective truth that is to be recognized, but in fact merely the result of whatever construct, whatever reasoning we want to put into place that would endow that life with sanctity, be it criteria for what makes a person or whether or not a person is functioning at a physical level? Is that the real problem here?
Yeah, I think that you probably said it better than I did, yeah.
Now, someone's going to look at this as a layperson, especially with regard to the ethics and the medical things, and say, look, my doctor is a decent man, and I don't think he's going to advise me wrongly when my husband is laying there and he has been in a car accident and he wants to be an organ donor. I don't think he's going to advise me wrongly. But is the doctor the only consideration here? Does the doctor himself have pressures upon him in a hospital beyond just his own ethical standards?
Well, I guess I would say that's a question that really you should ask doctors, and I think from my perspective on that, I would assume that physicians would retain a sufficient amount of independence in their diagnosis and treatment that they would be capable of doing the right thing. But I think there are pressures, and you know, I've read about that from doctors and heard them express it to me. So I know they are there, but I don't think it would be fair to say that, you know, people should be concerned about that. They should, you know, should talk to their doctors about what their view of life is. I mean, this is something they need to do, not even respecting organ donation, but there's a potential there that sometime life and death decisions are going to have to be made, and it's good to know that someone on your, you know, who's treating you has an understanding of what your values are.
How would you respond to the person who says, look, the greater good that could be achieved by increasing the number of organ donations, by relaxing the protocols with regard to brain death or heart death, outweighs any ethical concerns we ought to have about those protocols?
Well, I would say that one may never do evil in order that good may come of it, and to hasten or cause the death of even a dying person. And that, I mean, you know, that's an important point here. Even if the person is without doubt dying, you cannot hasten the death of that person for any good, and that would, directly to do that. So one would be doing evil in order that good may come of it. So no, you can't do that.
Finally, one of the things that I found curious, and I don't know if I'm concerned or not, is that in step 6 of the heart death protocol, as it's laid out in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, If the patient does not die, if the heart does not cease to beat for more than 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
after the ventilator is turned off, they're returned to the intensive care unit. Has that person, even if they haven't had their organs retrieved, still had wrong done to them?
Well, this is, again, a very good question. Why this is so ethically complex. I think one could make that argument because they haven't been treated with the respect that would be due a person. And they, at this point, of course, they, I mean, it's such a messy and complicated situation. Imagine that the expectation is that this person's heart is going to stop beating. 5 minutes, they're going to be turned over to the transplant team. Well, in an hour, it doesn't stop. So they send them back to the room with no other care except what the article refers to as palliative care. So think of what the situation must be for those who are having to make these decisions and those who are awaiting their loved one's death under the circumstances.
Father Ed Richard, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
Father Ed Richard is Academic Dean and Associate Professor of Moral Theology at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis. We've been talking about that St. Louis Post-Dispatch article, raising concerns that do need to be raised. When we come back from this break, we're going to be spending some time talking with two individuals. In the first half hour of that last hour, we'll be talking with Jim Truesdell about making Christian ethics a reality in the workplace. What kind of systems, what kind of policies can be put in place in the place of business so that ethics might be encouraged and not discouraged? He's president of the Brouwer Supply Company based here in St. Louis and co-author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June titled Christian Ethics in the Workplace. We'll round off this last hour talking with Dr. Leon Pottles, author of the book The Church Impotent, The Feminization of Christianity, about the importance of fathers to church going. Have you ever looked out into the pews on a Sunday morning and realized that there are more women than there are men? The national statistic is about 60-40, 60% women, 40% men. Has it always been this way? Why aren't fathers coming to church? Why are people coming to church in less numbers, period? And are those two questions related to one another? We'll talk about all of that in the second part of the last hour of Issues Etc. When we come back, we'll talk about Christian ethics in the workplace with one of the co-authors of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.